Hey, everybody, and welcome to Rogue Signal, episode 6, the weekly games podcast for Rogue.site, a very cool website that's just over a little over a month old at this point. It's all about video games. I'm one of your hosts and one of Rogue's co-founders, Brian Gilliam. With me are my two usual fellow co-hosts and co-founders, Jeff Parkin.
Hello.
And Cass Marshall.
Hello.
We got a slightly shorter than normal show for you this week, but that's because one of our co-owners and not usual co-hosts, Alice Jovenet, has a special interview with our old colleague, Matt Leone, who's the best, about this rad new gaming oral history project, Design Room. So stick around for that for the end. Matt put out some of the coolest, like, history related things at Polygon, really long, thoughtful pieces, like books on occasion. He's the best, and he's got his new thing. So please stick around and listen to that toward the end of the show. But with that all said, we're going to get into the meat of it here, just because we have a little bit less time. Cass, tell me about Thanksgiving in Canada, which is now?
Yes, so our Thanksgiving is a month earlier than your American Thanksgiving. And that's because, like, it gets colder here earlier, so our crops freeze earlier, I guess. I don't know.
Is that actually why?
Yeah, that's what I was told once as a child, and I never questioned it.
Running with it? All right.
But yeah, no, it should be a good time. I'll be going to see family this weekend, and, you know, I think there is a lot. You know, Thanksgiving definitely has some problematic origins, one could say, but overall, I think it's a good holiday. There's a lot to be thankful for, and I think, you know, it's nice to take a little time to be grateful for things. One thing I've been grateful for recently is, and I don't know about you two, but I have run into much fewer rude people in online games lately. I've been playing Darktide, Helldivers, lots of games with the pickup, and no one's called me a slur for, like, months.
That's true as well for me, but I feel like that's partially because I'm not playing a lot of Destiny right now. Not that Destiny's known for that kind of toxicity, but I'm not really playing stuff where that would happen, and also I sound like a white man over the internet, so I don't get yelled at in slurs. I get yelled at for other stuff occasionally, but never. But it's not the, like, oh, a femme voice over the internet, let's attack them thing. So it's not quite the same. But no, I've also not been targeted too recently. I can't remember the last time someone was toxic to me online. I've also been playing a lot of single player games.
Isn't that nice, though? I think we all remember an era.
Yeah.
That was just the assumed tax you get on.
You mean
the game.
When we were playing a lot of League of Legends? Yeah, I also
I mean,
remember.
I'm still playing League of Legends.
Really?
People are really mean in Wild. Well, it's Wild Rift, so you have to thumb type. So presumably, if you're thumb typing at someone, you're really mad.
Kaz, I got it. You brought it up, so I have to rant about it. I am still mad that Wild Rift has not come to consoles yet. I am, like, it's me. I'm the person who is, like, I stopped being able to, like, sit at my desk and play League of Legends all the time like I want to. I just don't have the time for it when I sit at my desk. I need to play other stuff. And so I was like, Wild Rift, baby. Like, I like it. I enjoy it. But I don't want to play with my thumbs. I want to play with the controller. But they said it's coming. They said it's coming to console. And that was, like, 7 years ago. Where is it? I'm, like, the only person on Earth probably waiting for it. But I'm mad about it. How is Wild Rift doing? I would like to be able to play it.
I mean, I'm having a great time with Wild Rift because they added Vel'Koz, who, if you're not familiar with League of Legends, it is a game with, like, 160 champions on PC. Mm-hmm. Not all of them have made it to mobile yet. So once in a while, they'll be like, hey, here's four or five guys, and, you know them from PC, but they're coming to your mobile device, yay! And Vel'Koz is a giant eye with three tentacles who shoots lasers. He is perfect. He is my beloved, and they added him, and I have an 80% win rate with him in ranked. So I have climbed up to Emerald, which is unprecedented.
Damn.
For me. I am, like, bronze on PC, so I'm, you know what, I'm going to take
thumb
the
skill.
Win. Yeah, I'm going to pretend I have somehow gotten substantially better at the game, and I'm just going to roll with that.
Do you think that, do you think your Wild Rift skills would translate even a little bit to the PC client?
At least a little bit, I would have to assume. Like, in terms of at least being aware of map cooldowns and knowing who a good chunk of the champions are, the real risk is, like, there would be some, like, champion that's on PC that I have never seen.
Yeah, at this point, that's my... That happens to me whenever I log in and play my annual game.
Especially because there's all the skins. You'll just see it. I'll just see a guy, and I'm like, who? Whomst are you?
Yeah. The game of, is this a new champion, or is this the craziest Volibear skin I've ever seen, is a real one at this point. I'm sorry, Jeff. This has become a League of Legends, retired League of Legends, and retired, semi-retired League of Legends podcast. This is supposed to be about Canadian Thanksgiving, and I destroyed it.
Well,
and
you know, that's fine, okay. Because I can ask, what are you thankful for, Jeff?
Oh, what am I thankful for? You know what, just because, we'll talk about this in a second, because we're playing Ghosts of Yotai, I am thankful for any game that has a really good photo mode. We use photo mode all the time in writing guides, and Ghost of Tsushima and Ghost of Yotai both have, like, best of the best photo mode.
So, yeah, that's a good, yeah, that's a good one. Silly thing.
I want to back up, though. Do you think that the lack of harassment is... like a tonal shift, or do you think it's because it's October and kids are going back to school?
I have no idea. Legitimately, like, I have to assume at least part of it is over the last few years, companies really have been making an effort overall to have their games not be a place where you go to get harassed, which, like, you know, I can understand why they would want that. That's presumably very good for marketing if you can be like, we do not operate the Torment Nexus.
Yeah, right.
And so...
You're saying you don't think that was good for League of Legends' reputation, that it had the reputation to be the most toxic game of all time?
I will say,
the entire time we played it?
I will say, at one point they added something called the Tribunal. And the Tribunal was... you would get, like, some in-game fun bucks if you read through chat logs and voted innocent or guilty. And I think that was the sort of thing they expected would, like, hey, this is a way for people to participate. It'll cut down maybe on our internal services, but surely this will be win-win. But really, people would just take the funniest quotes from the Tribunal and share them around and be like, this guy owns, what a legend. So I don't think that actually had the effect. Like, I vividly remember finding one log where it's just like, this guy's never won a game before. And his teammate goes, this Varus has never kissed a girl before. And Varus goes, come on, man, I'm in high school. And I just remember reading that and being like, wow, that is...
Oh, man.
Truly. Every person has their own story.
You are not doing anything to dispel any of the preconceived notions I have about League of Legends.
No. No. Why? No, they're probably right.
No one will insult League of Legends like a League of Legends fan.
Yeah. I spent so many hours, spent so much money on that game. That game, I love that game. It sucks so much ass. It's the worst. I love
it
so much.
I'm still shocked we got Arcane. Because for a long time, being a League of Legends fan is like Riot knocks on your door and you go, hello, Riot, what do you have for me? And most of the time, it's like, here's a new skin, right? Like, here's this new champion, and they're so cool. They're like an undead samurai guy. And they're like, okay. But then sometimes they're like, here's Arcane. It's a masterpiece. And you're like, well, oh my God. Whoa, are you going to do this again? And they go, maybe. See you later. Bye.
Yeah. That's the thing about Arcane, is that, like, all of my friends who play games played it. And League's reputation is still so toxic that I have friends who made Arcane their entire personality, and I still couldn't get them to play League of Legends with me. And, like, that's power. That's reputation right there, is like the degree to which this took over their lives. And they're still like, absolutely cannot, will not touch the source material. Too scary. Yep. Is incredible to me. Like day one Destiny Raiders who are like, absolutely not, too afraid of people. Like that, and they cornered the market on toxic fan base, even though the WoW fan base has always been technically more toxic in my opinion. But
we do have 2XKO, the League of Legends fighting game.
Yeah.
That will be entering, I believe, beta soon. So maybe that will be great and we'll see like a big influx of League lovers, even if they're not playing League itself.
The Riot MMO is where I'm putting all my like hopes and dreams and prayers, and which is very foolish, but that's where all of them are going. That's where they've been going for years at this point. I'm fully Riot MMO save us per peep like pilled at this point. I want to believe.
Is that perhaps what you are thankful, Ryan? Are you thankful for the specter of the Riot MMO, which we may see at some point in our natural lives?
I mean, I doubt it. Like, can you be thankful for something so truly ephemeral? I don't know. It's like something so unbelievably amorphous, perhaps. I don't know. I'm like, it's been a hard year, so I don't mean to be a bummer. I'm thankful that I have a lot of stuff in my life that matters much more than my job has ever mattered. Like, which sounds so trite, but like, my daughter got very cute, her very cute first school pictures last week, and they're somehow perfect. Like, she smiled like a normal person, and like, they did a good job. And the place did a good job getting her to like smile, even though she's two, and they're adorable and perfect. And then I'm thankful that we have grandparents who are like, oh, we can help pay for that, which is the best phrase anybody can say when you have a kid. So yeah, that's that. Like, all my thankfulness exists in the realm of outside games stuff, because game stuff sucks right now. I'm very thankful for this website and for my compatriots and for our readers. But that's almost
good
a little
save.
Too hokey.
Good save.
That's a little too hokey.
Yeah.
My like actual thankfulness stuff is all just like, I'm glad that I can exist outside of the gamer sphere for a little bit every day before re-entering into the arena to punch myself in the dick over and over and over again, as I have for decades now.
It is extremely important to make sure you are not getting gamer madness, and that requires, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we all need gamer madness therapy at this point. And like, I think I'm in a place in my life where I get a regular dose of that, and that's nice. You know, at some point you have to unplug from the Destiny mines to go do bath time, and that's cathartic. You know,
why don't
my touch grass recently has all been mowing grass. So I got
awful.
Frustrated dealing with some hardware issues over the weekend, and I went and mowed the lawn. So that's all I've got. It's a lot less fun than cute kid pictures.
How is your PC doing, Jeff? You're not to swing things back rogue-wise. I know you had hardware issues.
No.
How is that PC doing? Which people can read about your entire process of building through Project Jasper on the website.
It is fantastic. The final part six, will go up tomorrow, in which I decide it performs.
Tomorrow Tuesday or tomorrow Thursday?
Sorry, tomorrow Tuesday.
Okay, so it will be up by the time you're listening to this.
Yep, recording tomorrow, podcast yesterday. It performs right up alongside a PS5 and an Xbox. And
nice.
I am super happy with it.
I keep seeing you, I can tell you're testing it because I keep seeing you launch the Black Myth Wukong stress tester on Steam.
Yep.
How is that gaming program?
It is brutal. I can say that this is a budget PC, so this is not a surprise. But the second you even hover over the ray tracing option in the settings, the frame rate drops to 10. Like, it just becomes a slideshow simulator that at makes that sense. Point.
Is that game, is that the Crysis 2 of this modern era?
It's up there. I am using this one because it was the first one I found. Like, it's shockingly hard to find just a dress test of some sort. But yeah, it's also shockingly hard to figure out exactly what a PS5 or Xbox is doing or is capable of. Because they are both capable of running 4K and 120 frames per second. Neither of them are capable of running 4K and 120 frames per second at the same time. So there's a lot going on under the hood and behind the scenes that I kind of have to hand wave away to make Jasper sound better. But that said, I love using the thing. It's great.
How portable works.
Oh, it's the case. I say this in one of the articles, like, overall volume, the case that I ended up having to put it in is the same size as the PS5 and Series X put together. And I'm pretty sure the PS5 could fit inside the case. Also,
all right.
Also, this is my one big complaint. The goddamn motherboard does have Wi-Fi built in, but it has an external antenna. So I've got this stupid shark fin thing sitting on top of the case.
Incredible. I have an antenna, but it sticks out just of like the one of the ports, like an extender port on the back of it.
Yeah, this is a whole running wires shark fin thing sticking up off the top.
Incredible.
So it's janky and it's perfect. Also, I don't know if you guys saw this. I think Cass saw it because they edited my article. The power supply lights up. It's got LEDs in it.
Oh, yes.
Super cool. All of the fans have LEDs. The CPU cooler has LEDs. I can control all of the colors, and it does a nice, like, rainbow spectrum. But you can't control the colors on the power supply. So I've got a nice coordinated, like, spectrum shift, and then just red, white, and blue chasing in the power supply. So it's janky as hell, and I love it.
That is incredible, though. I love the idea that, you know, you have this carefully curated RGB gamer setup, and then there's the Rogue power supply twinkling in whatever colors it pleases.
Yep. Perfect. I'm pretty sure I was looking at it. I'm pretty sure I can just turn them off entirely, but I don't want to do that.
That's just admitting defeat.
Exactly.
Oh, all right, man. Let's get to the games at this point.
I'm going to grab that one. Speaking of admitting defeat, demo, a pinball game that makes you mad. Haven't seen this.
Thought this was a joke. I have not heard of this.
It is. I think the devs describe it as getting over it, but pinball. It is a one button video game where you are playing as a little guy trapped in a pinball, and the one button controls various flippers, and you just attempt to make your way through a weird level. Like, it's not a stereotypical pinball machine.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
like
I see this.
A tunnel and swooping and climbing. If I were to put it into like real world terms, I've maybe made it 50 yards in the like hour I've tried to play this game.
I appreciate the honesty of the name. Like, it is not, yes. You are not like colloquially referring to it as a pinball game that makes you mad. That is, if you were to look it up on Steam, the name of the game. They are very
just what
honest
it says in the
about
tent.
This transaction.
Yep. It is, the demo's out now. I don't know how much it's going to cost. It's a lot of fun for a couple of minutes at a time. Because
is this one of the,
is it hard?
Is it doing that thing that a bunch of people have been doing, and we've been getting a bunch of emails about people launching Steam Next Fest demos like 2-3 weeks early? It appears that's what
maybe.
This is doing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see if it pops up on Steam Next Fest. Steam Next Fest next week, one of my favorite like times of the year. We'll definitely be doing stuff for that. And I'm looking forward to. Okay, I do appreciate that on this game, one of the features is 2 to 1,000 hours of playtime. And it says in parentheses, pending skills.
See, there's, I think, a genre of games like this. Like, obviously, Getting Over It is the immediate inspiration. But recently, I found this little game. It's 250 Canadian. So probably even less for you Americans. It's called Unfair Flips.
Brutal, but not wrong.
You're flipping a coin, and if you get heads 10 times in a row, you win! Yay!
Oh my god.
Now, this could take, like, you know, 2 minutes. Or it could take, like it took me, 2,000 clicks in 4 hours. Because, you know, that's the thing with probability. And the game is just straight up telling you, like, this is about probability. It is about likelihood. You can upgrade the coin, but like the highest you can get the chance of a heads is like 60%. So you're just gonna be sit there clicking, and it's gonna go 1, 2, 3. You know, you're gonna think you're on a good roll, and then nope. The nice little guitar string that plays upon every head just stops dead, and you are back where you started.
God.
I believe there are 10 endings, and the way to get them is probability. When I got my ending, spoilers, I guess, my coin just exploded. And then the game started over. And I was like, I feel like the developer made this. I don't know. Like, it's not quite as, you know, straightforward as Pinball That Makes You Mad. The game just says, this is going to piss you off. But, like, as someone who has played XCOM and seen, like, 95% hit chance while I have a gun directly in an alien's mouth, like, he's using it to brush his teeth and I somehow miss, I do find Unfair Flips to be enlightening in some kind of way. I don't know what the takeaway is, but I'm thinking while I'm flipping, so that's something.
It seems almost like, and I don't mean this offensively, it seems almost like the game is designed to make you sit there and be like, how much time did I spend on this? Like, it seems like that's almost the purpose of the game, to make you reflect on how you spend your life.
Yeah.
And trying to get the 10 flips. And, like, that's brutal. That's, like, how different is this really than playing, I don't know, another World of Warcraft expansion?
The
chaos.
In the end, life is just a series of coin flips.
It is.
Yeah.
Cass, you and I played Midnight.
Yeah.
We did.
This is another World of Warcraft. I'm just gonna check out real quick.
Yeah, Jeff, go get a sandwich or something. We played the new World of Warcraft expansion. Yes, World of Warcraft Midnight, to be clear, for people who are not in on WoW, which, like, what are you doing? It's been here for like
a little bit of an indie title. You may have heard of it once or twice.
WorldofWarcraft.com, like 25 years old.
So yeah, Blizzard hosted a alpha summit for the new expansion where press and creators were invited. And now you have players in the alpha and they're streaming it. So this is a very public showcase of the new content, the new zones, dungeons, delves, basically everything you can expect from a new WoW expansion. And I have to admit, so far, things have been going, you know, pretty well. I've been very much enjoying my time with the War Within, and Midnight seems to be, in a very good way, more of the same.
Because they're doing this saga thing this time, where it's going like the World Soul Saga, where it's like three expansions, and weirdly, it's kind of like what Destiny did a couple years ago. But it's doing like the War Within, then Midnight, and then is it the Last Titan?
The Last Titan, which will take us to a overhauled Northrend. Which I like Northrend.
Do we know that? Oh, wow, that's rad. I didn't know that.
That was announced quite a while
ago. Oh, yeah. That's like starting to tickle the back of my brain. That's exciting. Yes. I wasn't really around for Wrath of the Lich King, so that's
so cool. Something I love about the World Soul Saga so far is Xalatath. And Ryan, I don't know, were you familiar with Xalatath heading into...
Oh, yeah. Legion, my most played expansion. So, I'm very well aware of Naifu.
I will explain this to Jeff as a total outsider. Yeah, this so is, he understands,
please,
and
please enjoy the saga of Naifu.
So in World of Warcraft, there was an expansion called Legion, and Legion is like everyone is getting class halls. You're going to hang out with all the paladins, are hanging out together, going on paladin adventures.
It was the best.
Very well received. And so every class also got three like hero weapons, and these were weapons from like the history of Warcraft. There were a lot of, you know, like, oh, you know this character who was so cool? You're using his mage staff. Whoa. And being weapons, I think it's safe to say that, like, these did not have much in the way of characterization, but a couple of them were talking weapons. I believe the Arcane Mage Staff was a little bit chatty.
I think so. That sounds right.
And then
the Skull of Mannoroth for the Warlocks was chatty.
Yes. And then Shadow Priests got a blade called Xalatath. And Xalatath was spectacularly cunty and always whispering all kinds of ominous shit, and people really liked her. And over the course of the next couple of expansions, so the Heroes of Azeroth used their powerful weapons to drain... This is another long,
the sword. We can't get into the sword.
A giant sword in the middle of a desert, and we're like, okay, we've moved on from these weapons. But Xalatath came back, baby. The champions of Azeroth found an evil knife on the beach, and it was like, bring me souls. And we went, I'm getting gold out of this. I'm getting experience. All right, heard, chef. And we gave the knife souls, and Xalatath emerged as an evil elf. And the world
with bare feet, very critical to understand. Bare feet. Tootsie's out.
So she is the main antagonist of the World Soul Saga. She's very mysterious, but we know she loves power. She is barefoot, and she enters every cutscene feet first.
Yep.
Which is very strange, but...
No, the WoW gooners are living for it. It is every thumbnail you see for World of Warcraft over the past 2 years and going forward is just purple elf feet.
This
wild.
Is not on the players. This is on Blizzard. Like, they are
they
the
know
ones
what they're doing.
Who are leading
it's,
each cutscene with her feet. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's a...
Going
it's
full Tarantino.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So, yes.
I mean, in a way, yes.
This evil, purple, barefooted elf is coming for us all. She has,
dogs out.
She has unknown goals of shadow and evil. But, like, she's actually a really likable villain, I'm going to say. A lot of WoW villains have just been like,
yes,
there's this cycle of, I have consumed too much power, and I wanted to do the right thing, but this artifact made me insane.
I'm the leader of one particular faction, and I keep getting evil for some reason.
There is a quest line in Legion where you find a group of Tauren who are like Minotaur
cow
people. They are called like the Blood Totem, like that's their last thing. And halfway through the quest, you realize they've done some evil shit and made deal with warlocks, and their last name all changes to Fel Totem.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which made me think, like, why would your name change because you're... It's like going to work, and a guy shakes your hand. He's like, hi, I'm Michael Manslaughter. And you're like, what? Like,
yeah. Well, I mean,
these are all... giant cow people that have like Native American indigenous like culture and general vibes around them in the same way that all the WoW cultures have some sort of weird thing like that. Like if the trolls all have vaguely Jamaican accents, and if you ask around about that, they're like, no, what do you mean? It's their purely unique takes on these cultures. There's, I don't know what you're talking
about.
Like
the Trade Federation and the prequels.
Yes. Almost every WoW race is very much that, except, yeah.
I feel like if you're coming to World of Warcraft for nuanced takes on global politics, don't want to say that's on you, but I do feel like it may be a little bit of a skill issue where it's like,
sure,
World of Warcraft has never been a nuanced game, you know, carefully representing real world politics. It is a game where someone shows up flying a giant sailor ship, but they're like making it with fly with magic, and then they shoot arcane cannons at you.
That cutscene was cool, though.
That cutscene was very cool. Was the writing around it great? No.
Who cares?
But like,
Jaina's outfit was great. It was a great change, great costume change. Laura Bailey, inspired casting.
Oh, nice. Is the purple elf lady barefoot important? Is she the one that I've seen on all of the like box art and key art over the last several years?
For the most recent?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Gripper's out. Because that's her, for sure.
I know nothing about World of Warcraft, so this is only, like, seeing it in passing.
Well, you've only had, like, a junior in college level time to learn about it.
Oh, I know.
It's like, it had a 20-year anniversary like 3 years
23?
Ago. Yeah, Jesus Christ. Yeah, the game, not the franchise, the game, the MMO.
And that is why, unfortunately, like, you know, there will be people who will say, I have moved on from Blizzard. You know, I do not support products from Microsoft. But as someone who has been playing since I was like a teenager, WoW will always have that little spot in me where it gripped its hook hooks in when I was 16. Now my character is like old enough to go and get an apartment and live on her own, which she actually can with player housing. Whoa.
Yeah, do you have a cast? Have you fucked around with player housing at all?
The player housing is cool, and I can already tell that I am going to like have to find the people who are going hard on it, because I played around with it and I made like a humble little house and I went, how nice. And then I looked on YouTube and people are making basements and like massive mausoleums and sculpture and all sorts of stuff. And I'm like, I see. Once again, I will be at the mercy of the YouTubers to explain how they do this, because I rarely have the patience to puzzle that out myself.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat. That's the kind of thing where I'm like, I will probably lose a lot of time to this. I don't think I would have when I first started playing, but I think how my taste has changed, I will probably lose a lot of time to that. But I think there's an element also where I think there was a couple of years there where I went really hot and heavy on the alphas and the betas. And now I'm like, I will touch them for content stuff. And then I kind of just wait until it comes out, because I want to have the normal experience with WoW. And then I've typically been putting it down and then checking it out every couple patches or something, just because I'm not deep in the end game like I used to. But I did play some of the new Demon Hunter class, and I wrote that up for the website. But it's doing some really cool things. I think like it really rounds out that class in a way that I like a lot. I don't know if you have this problem, but like Demon Hunter feels like the best class to play. For context, Jeff, this is it's a class they added like in that Legion expansion a couple of years ago, or like 8 years ago at this point. But like it plays like a modern video game. Like you can double jump and glide as this class, which is like very much not how World of Warcraft plays typically. It just makes it feel super good. But the problem that I've always had with it is that the playstyle that you have to take it into like end game content is very unfun, in my opinion, because it's a lot of like dashing through the boss back and forth, and like it's just you're like playing like you're like you do a line of Adderall and then you like jump on there and see how fast you can go through the boss and on your cooldowns. It's wild, and I don't have fun with it, but I love playing the class. This new version of it is more of like a caster. It's a little bit like, it's not that it's not, I mean, it's very simple, but it's also a little bit more like step back, do the mechanics more easily because you have a lot more range, which is more of my speed these days. So I'm personally very excited about it as somebody who has always wanted to be able to enjoy taking, like, playing Demon Hunter, and then I get to the place where I'm like, all right, ready to take my stuff into endgame content, and I'm like, I don't want to do what I have to do on this class now to make that work, so I'll go play some other compromised class that is not as fun to play, but that I actually want to take in any of content. So I'm hoping it'll make that barrier for me.
I am perhaps the opposite in that I have been playing my Paladin for 20 plus years, and I always play my Paladin. Like, I have alts, definitely, but I never really take them into the end game. I just like to dress them up. And Blizzard, if you are listening, please make it so I can have my alts hang out at my house. Wouldn't that be fun?
Can they not do that? I thought they said they were, that was the thing they were doing.
I mean, it's possible. I didn't, it's not implemented yet. If it is, I believe December is when
that's gotta happen.
Shot at it. So we will see.
Yeah, that comes out, it'll be an alpha for a couple months now. It comes out at the end of February, I believe, is what they have announced for it. So, yeah, you know, it's World of Warcraft, but they're still doing stuff with it. I mean, the player housing thing is huge. That's been, like, people have been talking about that for forever. I know personally, I'm very excited to see what you end up finding that people are doing and putting on the website. That's something I think, for those first couple months, I will be endlessly thrilled to see pop up and jump into an edit for, to be able to get to be the first person to see your roundup for that type of shit, because that's, like, that stuff's going to be really fascinating. The tools are really extensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked about this a little. I talked about this a little bit last week, but I don't think it's technically on your list. But Jeff, I know you started Clover Pit because I've seen you play it.
Yep.
And so I'm going to make you talk about it. I want to know what you think about it.
Clover Pit is a, like, crunchy horror slot game. Like, you are trapped in a closet with a slot machine and a pit to hell under you, and then you kind of blotro your way through, changing your luck, kind of like unfair flips. I really like it.
It's
really
fun.
Good.
Have you broken it yet?
It's never gonna be more. No, I haven't.
Okay.
No.
That's like...
I know... Let's see. I've gotten the key. I've never done anything with the key. I think the most my debt has gotten up to is like 20K.
Okay. Yeah. It's definitely... We talked about it a little bit on the podcast last week, and I wrote it up for the site. I wrote something about it on Friday, a preview for it. But it really is like... you will find that combo. It's a thing where I'm sure as I get better at it, as I understand it more, I will be able to more often succeed. But it's the kind of thing where you're going to lose a lot of runs because you just don't find the right stuff or you just can't latch onto it. But then when you can finally do it, it just, like, totally breaks. So, like, Jeff, the run that I had last week before I wrote the thing up, was I had this run where, like, I had all these trinkets that every seventh pull or the last pull of a group would target, like, crazy luck and a bunch of other stuff and cause things to, like, do, but it was all on sevens, like, or all on, like, on the seventh pull. So basically I would go and I would pull seven times on a round, and the first six, I would get, like, nothing, like, no money. It was just garbage. Like, didn't matter what I got. Didn't matter if I got the 666 to pop up and take all my money away from me. Didn't matter. Because then I would get to number seven and I would get, like, a jackpot every time because of all the charms that I had would just work to be like, you get a jackpot every time. And every time I get a jackpot, it causes, like, my things to scale up. So now treasure chests are worth so much more every single time. And then everything is worth so much more. And then this thing multiplies over and over and over again. Every time I get one of those jackpots, it's just over the course. I went, like, eight or nine deadlines by just doing like jackpot only build, which is different than another build that I've used to break the game about that was just that was a lot more susceptible to stuff like those 666 chaos thing, but was more like a build about getting as many diamonds as I could and making diamonds like super valuable. Like there's just so many like Balatro and other games like this, there's just so many different ways to find stuff to combo together to break it. And just completely like shatter your debt. And then you get like memory cards and weird stuff that you can use to like change the rules of every game. But like, I mean, you've gotten the key, so you've at least gotten your way, the first keys. You've at least gotten your way to like figuring out, seeing in a world of how you can break this slot machine to do what you want to do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like finding those trinkets that work together to break the rules is really fun. Like that's the appeal of those games. I will say, like, at least Balatro, you're still playing poker. Like you're still doing something. And in this, once you've picked out your trinkets, the strategy is really like push the button to pull the lever. So like, it's not going to be the most engaging gameplay, but it is really good. It's fun. I've got no complaints.
Yeah. It's creepy. I like that it's creepy. Like it feels very October. And when you're pulling the slot machine, and under the slot machine, there's just a bucket with organs in it. Just feels a little, just a little spooky. It's a good time. It's a neat game. Cass, you playing Darktide?
Yes.
More so, still? We talked about this a couple weeks ago, right?
Yes. Yeah, so something I really love about Darktide is you're not playing a space marine or anyone who's cool in the setting. You're playing kind of the fucked up dregs at the bottom of the societal ladder. And I have specifically been playing and enjoying the game's fourth class, the Ogryn. So
the big boy?
The big boy. So everyone else is just normal human size. You have psykers, zealots, marksmen, and arbitrators. And they are all just people. They have their own aesthetics. Ogryns are just big boys. So your animations are different. Everyone else, when they put a device down, they have to hold it in both their hands, whereas the Ogryn pinches it between his thumb and forefinger. You're taller than everyone, so you block their line of sight quite often because you're just so dang big. But the Ogryn is just written to be... There are three personalities that every class has, and I have chosen the most like lovable, silly one. So I'm just doing things like I'm offering everyone my rations. I'm telling everyone, right away, And I don't know what's going on. Everyone else has like these revelations about their backstories, their thoughts on Imperial society. And I'm worried about eating, and most importantly, throwing a rock. Because every class has a grenade slot. And for the Ogryn has a box of standard grenades, just like a whole ass bomb or a really big rock. And I have just been having the most delightful time throwing the rock at everyone, watching them crumple under the rock. Sometimes the Ogryn will even say, "Go make friends, rock," or "Go get them, rock." Every Ogryn player is delightful. I have never met a rude Ogryn. They're just the best. Like in a genre full of hardened soldiers and super cool agents, I love my big, silly Ogryn.
It's delightful. This is like, I feel like I want to revisit this game with like actual people instead of just doing random queue for it, because that's always what I end up doing with Vermintide as well. And this is the Vermintide people, right? Like it's the same developer.
Yes, Fat Shark.
Okay. Yeah, and like those games are super fun, but like they can get really hectic and crazy, and it's more fun when you can coordinate a little bit and do some stuff. And like, yeah, I spend some time on the Oberyn when I was playing, and like, it's a good time to just, I love a game where you're just like, where it moves the camera depending on how tall or big your character is. And you're just like so much bigger than everyone else when you're in Oberyn, as you see over everybody. It's delightful.
It is incredible that the marksman has a bunch of barks being like, please move out of my way. I can't see anything. Because the Oberyn is just so large. And you don't notice that it's first person, so you never notice when you're blocking someone's shots. But, like, you definitely are.
It's incredible.
Love it.
Jeff, what is the Hole Keeper? Sorry, if you have another question about big boys, I don't want to stop you, but...
No, I do. Is the Oberyn new? Like, I'm watching the trailers, and they're featuring prominently.
Yeah, they've been there since the start. The newest class is the Arbitrator. I just think it's great because the Arbitrator has a shield and a mace. The Arbitrator has a taunt. Like, there's some overlap in the Venn diagram between the Arbitrator and the Oberyn.
Gotcha.
But why would I be Judge Dredd when I can be the big boy who's going, go make friends, Rock. My friends, every time we play, I just occasionally punctuate in Discord channels, but get rocked, idiot. And they love it.
Love it. Okay, sorry, Ryan. You were asking me about the Hole Keeper.
Yeah, I was. What is that? Another game on your list that has just a bizarre name.
Yep.
That makes
sense. Yep. That's the same way I pick out wine, actually, is I just look at the name.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
The Hole Keeper is a new game, unreleased. They do have a playtest out now. It is another super crunchy PSX style graphics. The entire premise is you are some brand new janitor acolyte. You ride an elevator down to a basement hallway. You pick up a bucket, fill it with pink sludge. You carry it down the hallway and dump it into the hole so the hole doesn't get angry. And then you turn around and fill the bucket again and dump it into the hole. While that's happening, like, periodically the lights will go out and you have to turn them on. You have to clean up all of the blood that you've spilled. And there are just terrifying monster creatures that come running at you while you're on a timer for dumping your bucket into the hole. So, yeah. Just a super weird, super creepy, nice and simple game. I don't know that they have a release date yet, but you can apply to be in the playtest, and I really like it.
That sounds upsetting.
It is upsetting.
But like intentionally so.
Yep.
Huh. Sounds like it belongs in our spooky game conversation from last week.
I do feel like, you know, there are times where on the job hunt, I would love a listing that's just, if it's assuming it's well paid, just drop the sludge in the hole. I'd be like, you know what? Incredible. I feel very well equipped, but sludge in a hole. Like, you know, I feel as though minimum wage horror is becoming such a thing where it's like, why is my character here? Why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. You got to pay rent.
Yep.
Oh. Well.
Someone's got to put the sludge in the hole.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or it gets angry, apparently.
Yeah, I do also appreciate, to your point, Cass, like, you're not fighting the monster that comes running at you. All holding down the left mouse button does is it closes your eyes. And then you just wait it out until it's gone. Like, job is to wait it out.
Based.
So, yeah.
Extremely based.
It popped up in one of the like announcements that we get, and big fan. Like the playtest, really cool.
That sounds like icky and fun.
Yep.
In a cute way. All right, well, before we get to to Ghosts of Yotei, the one thing I had on my list is I spent a little time with Mars First Logistics this morning.
That has been in early access forever.
Yes. And as we've been over in the past, anytime I hear logistics on something, I jump on it because I assume it's going to allow me to build some shit or farm some shit or just in general, like make a town or something. And that's not really what this game is. No. I know you've played a little bit of it, Jeff, but like
it is
fun, though. It's kind of like Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts, but if you were a Mars Land Rover. Like, you start out as this, like, very modular little Mars car, and you're driving around. The art style's gorgeous. It's, like, probably the most eye-catching things about it. I don't even know what you would call that, like, the art on it.
It's kind of cel-shaded.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying, but it's not exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of reminiscent of, like, the Kentum art from the demo that we talked about last week. But it's very just colorful and vibrant.
Like comic book style.
But it's Mars and you're driving around with this little buggy and you're kind of like making deliveries and lifting stuff, but the thing is, like, you put all these, have these modular pieces that you can put on to yourself and like blueprints that are basic, but you're gonna have to change them to do jobs properly. So like you might have a claw thing to grab something, but that, and they can grab it and lift it like a mnemonic device, or like not mnemonic, like a pneumatic. Yes, thank you. Can like lift it and then can lift it like up and down like a like an XY axis. But then you might need to, okay, well that's not enough because you can't get it high enough. So then you need to go into your different parts that you have and like add a rotator onto it. So now you can take it and now you go XY, but now you get it up to the place where it needs to be or on the shelf, and then you can rotate it backwards, get it to where you need to be into the box, and then it takes it. And like the game seems to be getting more complicated as I only played for like an hour of it. But you know, at some point it's like, oh, okay, well now you're building a radio tower. Now you can build out scout locations to get more of an idea of the area around you and go do more jobs to get more cash that you can use to build more radio towers and soup out like your Mars rover so it can do a variety of different jobs. It just came out of early access at the end of September. It seems like a neat little thing. Like it's kind of a open, I mean, I don't know if you call it open world, but it's like it's a puzzle sandbox where the game kind of like hands you a variety of get this item to this place things and then doesn't exactly tell you like how to do it or what you need to do to the blueprint that it gave you to make that work.
It's so there are other games that have that same, it's similar premise. It's not unlike Kerbal Space Program. And there's that other game called Trailmakers is the same idea. Trailmakers is another like build your car kind of game. Build your car as you go kind of game.
Yeah.
I do dig Mars First Logistics.
It seems very versatile.
Like it's a fun Lego-y kind of game.
Yeah. Yeah, it very much has, it's like cel-shaded, but it gives that vibe like of the rover and everything to where it kind of looks like the very old school like Lego Mars rover sets type stuff on the aesthetic of everything. But like you can, you know, like if you watch the trailer, you can like make, it's very modular. So you can make like airplanes and shit flying around on Mars, or like actual satellite landers and stuff, or monster trucks, all from this like basic form that you're driving. It seems really neat. It's definitely something that has like seems like a lot of room to grow, but even just playing it for a little bit, there's just a lot of, it asks a lot of you in terms of your own ability to like come up with stuff and have like strong senses of ingenuity. But it seems to reward you for that as well. And your ability to, it's not like a Twitch type of thing. Like if you can find a way, like it might have one idea for how you're going to grab something, but if you can figure out a way to get a grabber, just like flip it onto your back and jank your way up a hill with it, like that's more than enough for the game. It seems very free and cool, and I see why. I saw it had such like great reviews, and so I wanted to check it out, and I'm probably gonna jump back in and check it out more later for sure. It seems very interesting.
For sure. It I'm has been to hear how your time with it changes. But before we wrap up and head out, there is one big release we've very briefly mentioned, and that is Ghost of Yotai. And now I have not been playing that, but Jeff, Ryan, have either of you had any time sunk into it yet?
Quite a bit, for I think both of us.
So what are your like early impressions of it? I'm very curious.
I said this to Ryan, I think, in one of our chats. I'm really torn on it because Ghost of Tsushima is a capital G great game. Like, it's fantastic. It's gorgeous. I love that game. And Ghost of Yotai is more Ghost of Tsushima. So that is just flat out a good thing. It's also not new. Like, I don't feel like it's pushing any boundaries with what Ghost of Tsushima set up. So I really like it. I just don't. I don't know. I don't see what sets it apart, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I think I actually have the opposite perspective, which is that I think Ghost of Tsushima is a capital F fine game. It's like that game to me does like nothing particularly special. Like, I remember when it came out, a bunch of people were at like work being kind of dismissive about being like, this game looks like it's not going to be anything interesting or special. And I'm like, I don't know, it looks kind of neat. And then it came out and everyone else loved it. And I was like, it's cool. Like, which happens sometimes. And that game's fine. Like, I had to do, I did work with it. Jeff and I both did stuff for it. It's a fine game. I beat it. It's cool. But I've never really gotten the, like, some people speak about it very effusively, and that's never been me. But so I was like, I was not that excited about Yotei at all. Other than like we talked about it last week, I like Eric Ishii a lot. I was very excited for them that they get to be the lead character in this. But I was not like dying to play it. I'm still not dying to play it, but I do find myself oddly drawn to it. Like, I have more Hades 2 to play. I've beaten that, but I have, like, some side stuff I want to get done on it. And yet I find myself doing, like, a run of Hades a day and then playing just, like, sinking a bunch of time into Ghost of Yotei. And I'm not really somebody who enjoys just, like, random bullshit in open-world games. Like, I find it very tedious. My OCD latches onto it really hard, and it's very difficult for me to, like, genuinely focus and have fun with it because I feel like I have to do everything. But there is a effortlessness to Yotei's exploration that I find really cathartic and kind of soothing in a way that, like, it doesn't trigger my OCD really bad. And it also doesn't, like, make me feel like it's all necessary. And usually I don't really love, like, diegetic, explore at your own pace, find all of the stuff, things in games, because it stresses my OCD out. Open world stuff really either plays well for me or it really doesn't because of the way my brain works. And when it gets to a place where it feels like I can't find everything very well, it stresses me. But they've just done some really smart stuff in Yotei, which is which they bring forward from Tsushima, to be fair, to just make exploration feel calm and exciting. And like the spyglass thing is fine. It's a way to do it. Like the golden bird that flies around is a thing that they had in the other ones. Like, it's a great way to get distracted, or just like looking at the map and seeing natural land points on the map that I'm like, that looks interesting. I'm going to go check that out. They just do a really nice job about that. And so I've just lost a bunch of time just wandering around. And I think part of it is that I think just this, the area of like Izo, the area of Japan that it's in, I think is just gorgeous. It's just a lot. To me, it's a lot more interesting. Like the mountain ranges and all the, like the meadows around it, I think just think are more visually appealing to me, and so I'm more sucked into it. I think like a lot of open world games, I'm kind of like avoiding doing the main story because it just doesn't, so far it's not super gripping to me. I kind of, for as much as I love Erica, I kind of feel the same thing I felt about Jin, which I just feel like all the characters in the world around me have a lot more personality than my character themselves. Just kind of like Atsu's has a little bit more personality than Jin did, but it's still just like not a whole lot. But every time I get into combat, it feels really great. And then every time I jump back on my horse, I just want to go. I have a mission ahead of me, and the wind literally takes me somewhere else. And so I'm finding myself like not super hype about it, but still getting that weird, like that. I'm not like excited to go play it every day, but I get this pull to do so that only seems to show up in me when I'm enjoying something. So I feel weird about it, but yeah, I am continuing to play it regularly and having fun and feeling satisfied right at the end of my session.
It's a weird, like, damning with faint praise situation to be in. Because
exactly.
It is. It's another, you know, really good to great game that I just kind of enjoy. Like, I don't love it, but there is nothing wrong with it. Like, combat is still great. It's still gorgeous. Like Ryan said, exploration is fantastic. It's just kind of there for me. It's not, I don't have that same draw.
Yeah.
I will say, I wrote about this in the beginner's guide. The one biggest change, and I 100% my favorite part of the game, is when somebody tells you about a location, like, hey, I saw an altar up the river here. In your map, you get a little postage stamp map. And
yeah, they'll draw your fake little map.
Yeah, and you have to line it up with like the topography of the world. And you
It's really
it
cool.
There.
Super it's
cool,
really, really cool.
Super simple thing. A great way to do open world. Like, find this thing to do.
And it helps you familiarize yourself with the landscape better as well. Like, mm-hmm. I find that like the map for an open world map is not humongous, which is actually good in my opinion. And like, you really get an idea of being like, oh, I've been in this main area for a while now. So when I get something, I'm like, oh, this is this part of the river. This is this part of the river. And that translates really nicely to when you're actually physically in the world as well. It's a really like impressive shift.
There's definitely, I think, like a big gap between the two extremes of, you know, there's towers everywhere, and if you climb them, it shows you exactly where to go, and your screen is always going, beep, beep, there's a side quest.
Yep.
And the other extreme, which is an NPC going, I think it's past the wheelbarrow, by the way, and also they're lying, and you have to cryptic, you know, write down all of their cryptic clues and talk to the scullery maid. So it sounds like this strikes a nice balance between those.
Yeah.
What,
I agree.
What game did that? Isn't that like Witcher 3 does that?
I'm not sure about Witcher 3. I know the old Fallouts does it. Does it do it? I know Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 can be tricky like that.
Yeah. Like, go to the tree and turn left and maybe you'll find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Games where you feel like, oh, I missed the dialogue and now I actually don't know what to do. I mean, Hades 2 does that to a degree, where like that game doesn't really have a quest log, and so there's an element of it where you kind of, if you're not listening to what the characters are saying, when they're like, "Oh, you need to go do this thing," you're like, "I have no idea where to find that," and that. So, like, I think that's a slightly different format, but something similar. One of the things with Yotei that I'm finding most interesting, though, is not really about the game itself. I feel like people, maybe this is the group I've curated, I feel like people aren't talking about it like it's a AAA Sony game that just came out, like a AAA story-based Sony game, something like a God of War or a Spider-Man or a Wolverine. Like, for how much people talked about Tsushima, and it became like a tentpole, like people loved that game. Is it just because the crybabies are mad about...
I've seen a decent amount of people talking about it.
Great.
I think sometimes there are properties where... like, people will be talking about it, but they're just like, huh, I really liked this little feature. This character was fun. oh, what about this mission? And it's very low-key dialogue that just doesn't show up on your feed unless you're, like, actively looking for it. Mm-hmm. And then there are games where everyone's, like, talking about it, but it's all, you know, bot-inflamed, like, nonsense about, like, Ghost of Wokai. So I have seen a pretty good amount of normal, natural just conversations about it in the wild. I have no idea how it's doing in terms of sales or popularity, but people seem to be enjoying it from what I see.
Yeah.
Great,
and,
yeah.
And I hate that Ghost of Wokai is so good. Like, that's really good. That's really good troll branding, but...
I'm really mad that I've seen people call it Ghost of DEI. It's like Ghost of Wokai is right there.
Yeah.
Why are you even grifting if you're not even going to go for that low-hanging fruit? Get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, really. I don't think the people who are grifting and they're being sincere about it are necessarily operating to a level where I think they would appreciate the quality level of how they're trolling. I think they're just like keyboard smashers at that point.
Skill issue.
Exactly. Like, they're just not even hating well at it. They're just being pieces of shit about it. They can't even have, like, they can't even be fun about it at all. The trolls.
But do you know where you can find fun, not bad faith video game writing criticism?
Yeah,
and
perfect.
Discourse.
It's really good.
Is it Matt, former Polygon writer and coworker of ours, Matt Leone?
That's right, Ryan.
Wow. Okay, well then we're going to leave this normal section of the podcast. Thank you for listening. We'll be back at the very end to say bye and do our usual spiel. We're going to leave you now in the very capable hands of Alice here to talk to you, Matt. So please enjoy that and we'll be back.
Hello, I'm here with Matt Leone, formerly of Polygon.com, and we're here to interview him a little bit about his new website. Now, Matt, we obviously know each other from working at Polygon together, but for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you've worked maybe other than Polygon, and some of the projects that you've worked on?
Sure. Yeah. I started making a print fanzine, if you want to go back that far, maybe what, 30 years ago, give or take. Did a few of those, did some like independent websites, did an internship with Official Xbox Magazine, worked for gamers.com a little bit in the old days, and then basically what anyone would know me from is I had worked at 1UP for about 10 years and I worked at Polygon for about 13. So
that's so you me, come from the days of like print like print media as well, like print gaming magazines.
If you count the fanzine, that was print. Yeah. I did work on EGM a little bit when I was at 1UP, like towards the last few years of that. We were all kind of on both, so I was doing that. But yeah, I was around print, but I didn't work too much in it apart from that little window there.
Okay, cool. So we brought you here because you're starting an independent website. Like a lot of people that are formerly from media, we're all starting independent websites. So if you could tell us a little bit, like, what is it called? What's the focus? And also, like, as kind of like a follow-up to that, how are you hoping to kind of carve out a space for yourself in this current like ecosystem of independent games media? Like, how is this site going to assert its identity in this space?
Yeah. So the site's called Design Room, and it's basically built around oral histories. So like I think you mentioned before, I had done some of these at Polygon, both as a writer and an editor. Probably most notably, there was like Final Fantasy VII one and Street Fighter II series. I liked them a lot. I liked like kind of the context they bring to some of these stories that you may have heard a little bit, but you may not have heard from as many voices or in kind of this way. The new site is basically designed to do a lot more of those, different types of games, different kind of approaches to covering these stories that you may have heard a little bit of, but maybe not the whole thing on. And let's see. I mean, it's how is it, what was the other question? Like, how is it going to be different from other websites out there?
Yeah. The fancy way I put it is just like, how is it going to assert its identity? But it's like, okay, it's oral history, which is definitely a different approach to kind of documenting game history or like the making of video games. But I was curious if there's going to be some kind of like additional like wrinkle or a different tack that you're trying to take with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think compared to most of the independent sites out there, it's very specific. Like, I think, you know, like looking at Rogue or some of the other sites, they're more general interest. They cover a lot of different things. Kind of like a shotgun blast of like trying to get everything out there. That is the complete opposite of what this thing is. We're doing a small number of stories, and they're each going to be very long and kind of in depth. So it's not really trying to cover everything. It's not going to cover a lot of like new stuff out there. It'll be somewhat retrospective and somewhat a little bit more recent than it's not a full retro site, but it's very much focused on like, okay, what are like a few big bets? What are like a few big stories we can track down and kind of put a lot of time into, rather than try to kind of do a little bit of everything. So it's very specialized in that way, and I think that is kind of what I'm more interested in. And I think what in some ways I think it's good just in that like you say, there's a lot of sites out there, both independent and not, that are kind of trying to do some of the other stuff. So I didn't want to like compete directly with that. I wanted to kind of do something that was a little bit different.
Cool. Yeah. I've been a fan of your work and the stuff that you've done at Polygon, like the oral history stuff. But is it possible to give us a short preview of like the lineup of projects that you have in mind for Design Room? Like, what can readers expect to see in like your first month?
Yeah. So I don't remember. Is this going to run before or after the site goes live? That might change my answer a little bit.
We're planning to run this alongside next week's episode of the podcast. So be as like teasery or spoilery as you feel like you want to be. Like, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything like that. So if you don't feel comfortable answering, or if you don't have that kind of ready, we can just move past that. That's okay too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really want to say Shadow of the Colossus is the thing you're talking about. Like, that's the big first story that's going to be kind of the whole first month is based around that.
Right.
I kind of want to keep that a surprise until it's actually out there, because I don't want to like set expectations where people think it's going to be something and then they could be disappointed by it. I think it'll work better if it just kind of, they see it and then it's like right there available. So I can answer vaguely, but I don't think I'd really be able to mention anything specific if you want.
Okay, we get it. No, that's fine. If we want to leave that as like a surprise, that's okay too. Like, we can say that'll be a surprise for your readers when the site goes up. That's totally okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay, yeah. So all right, you've done you focused mainly on oral histories, right? So you kind of went into this, but like, what is it about that particular like documentary format that you enjoy the most, and what are the benefits that it offers maybe over other documentary formats?
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about this for a long time. I think the simplest answer is just, I like the context it brings. Like, you often hear, like game history stories told from like one person's voice. Like, maybe it's the producer or the director or someone who was kind of a high profile. And I like the idea of interviewing a lot of people who worked around them, whether that means artists or musicians or people worked in like other parts of the business, like marketing or business development or, anything really. I think there's all kinds of interesting angles to games, and, they're often told in a very kind of linear kind of way. So I like the idea of having different voices in there, both because sometimes they remember things differently. And, you know, like I definitely have learned by doing this that, like, there's not always like a correct answer for these things. A lot of times it's just how people remember things. And I think showing the different ways they remember them is valuable and interesting. It's also sometimes entertaining too, because they may, you know, disagree on something, or they may, you know, just have a different kind of memory of it, and different kind of stories to tell. So I think that part of it really appeals to me. And I like the idea of, you know, just kind of putting these quotes next to each other too, where it's not just like, I think a lot of times when there's a lot of like game history interviews out there, like you could watch like long YouTube interviews that are like, you know, hours long. But I feel like they're not always kind of edited down to the most interesting parts. So I like the idea of like, if you like look at like a math equation, like I'd rather interview 10 people and pick out the best 5 or 10 minutes from each of those interviews, rather than kind of interview one or two people and just run the whole thing. And it obviously takes a lot more time. But I feel like that produces a better or more interesting story, just because you get the best parts of them instead of just like a little bit of everything. Compared to other formats, like I think there's value in every format. But yeah, like I think there's a lot of value in text. I think there's a lot of value in kind of putting the quotes back to back. I think, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, but I think this is the one that really appeals to me.
Cool. Yeah. So obviously you're not a stranger to like documenting game development or gaming history, and there's probably a lot of research that goes along with like any sort of documentary project, but I'm curious kind of what is the most unexpected or surprising thing you've discovered in your research. And you don't have to talk about like upcoming projects. It can be like an older project.
Ooh, that's a really hard question to answer. yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of times you don't always like, it's interesting too, because like the way I structure these stories, you kind of have to know what you're looking for when you go in. Like, if you're doing like an interview with someone, just like a one-on-one interview, you can be a little more freeform and kind of see where it goes. Whereas when you're doing like an oral history, you want to do some of that, because just for like exploration and to find out what's out there and like what stories are interesting. But you also need to have a little bit more of a structure to it, just in terms of like, okay, you need multiple people to comment on the same topic so that you can then put that together later. Mm. So in some ways it forces you to kind of like ask the same questions over and over again, to get different people's perspectives, which I think is interesting. And sometimes that does dig up stuff that you didn't expect. Nothing's really jumping out at me right now, but there's all kinds of little pieces of information that pop up when you're doing stories like these. I guess this isn't like some huge thing, but like when I was doing the Final Fantasy VII story a while back, there was one of the guys I interviewed who worked in marketing, and you wouldn't necessarily expect him to have like a bunch of old documents, but he dug up like this pile of old, like just copies of internal paperwork that he had, that had like old, like marketing plans for early, like Squaresoft games in the 90s and stuff. And there was like a huge list of like every time a commercial for this game had run on like, I think it was MTV or different channels. And it was just like time coded, like list of like all the times they had run commercials. And it's like, no one really cares about like exactly what those are, but it's just kind of seeing those documents was fascinating. And seeing like how the marketing department viewed some of these games. And like, you know, it's a lot of times you assume that like, oh, back in the day, like game magazines just like didn't have very like accurate information. And that's true. But a lot of times game companies didn't have that much accurate information either. So like the magazines were just reporting kind of what they could get out of the companies. And like, you know, the US branch of a Japanese company may not have like been fully informed on most of this stuff either. So I think it's interesting showing that and kind of how they viewed things on their side, even if, you know, you'd think they would know more than they actually did.
Yeah. So it's less of a journey of kind of like discovery and just kind of getting it focuses more on the variety of perspectives that you get from the development process, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think that ideally you'd have time to do both, and you can just kind of like spend time kind of exploring anything you can think of. But then at the end, you also have to kind of go back to everybody and be like, okay, now we need to kind of fill in all the holes here. So, yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, you do both, and we certainly try, but it depends on the story and the time and all that.
I mean, if you had unlimited resources, right, I mean, you would just go for it would just go forever. But, yeah, you do need to kind of cut it off at a certain point, right? On that note, like, if you could document a game that you might have previously, like, not had the resources or access to undertake, what would that game be and why?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of games I want to do that just haven't been able to come together for different reasons. It's weird, some of the hoops you have to jump through for these kinds of things. Like, there are a lot of companies where like people are allowed to speak freely on Twitter or Blue Sky or wherever else, but not in an interview. Like, they just have certain restrictions that companies put on them. There's a lot of people who can't talk about things because the companies they used to work for don't want them talking about, or the companies they currently work for don't want them to talk about other company stuff. Like, there's all kinds of weird things like that that can kind of make things not come together. So yeah, I mean, there's probably a dozen projects that I would like to do that I could either haven't been able to, I either haven't been able to get to it yet or just, you know, I may never be able to. We'll see. If there's one that I could like fix or improve, I guess it would be the Street Fighter series, which is kind of a weird thing to say because that's the biggest thing I've done, like in terms of number of interviews and number of stories, and we turned it into a book and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, I still feel like, I mean, it was a big story to kind of bite off in the first place, but I still feel like there were certain gaps in that that project that I would like to fill in. And that's not necessarily because of time. Like, I spent a lot of time on that. A lot of it came down to like company politics and like who was allowed to speak and who wanted to speak and that kind of stuff. So like, I feel like that story got we got very far in terms of what we wanted to do, but like, and I think part of it too is that that's like my favorite series, so that you know, you always want it to be perfect. But if I only, like, you know, I probably got 75% of the people I wanted to speak to in there, and I would love to get to the other 25%. But yeah, I don't think that's as much a matter of time as it is kind of just certain things not being able to come together for access reasons.
Just logistics, yeah, not lining up necessarily. So when you're researching a specific title, like, besides like talking to the people that you know worked on that title, what is your best resource for knowledge on that title? Like, are there any kind of assets or other things that are revealing, like, you know, forbidden knowledge to you during the process?
I mean, yeah, use anything you can get. I think a lot of times I'm talking about older games, I'm getting old magazines and you know, doing lots of Google searches and Internet Archive is my friend. But yeah, it really just depends on the story. Like, sometimes I need to track down people who used to work on magazines to be like, hey, what did you mean by writing this thing? And then I'd take that back to someone who worked on the game and was like, hey, they said this, what do you think about that? And you know, there's every little detail is different for every story, so it's kind of hard to answer, but definitely use anything I can find or anything I need.
Just said anything and everything. So that kind of ties into this next question, is that I feel like gaming history kind of as a cultural touchstone has a strange way of being simultaneously like well documented but poorly preserved, if that makes any sense. So my question is, what can people do besides supporting like the work of like historians and documentarians in this space to be like better stewards of gaming history? Like, do you think that there's something that we could all be doing to better preserve this knowledge?
I mean, yeah, I don't really put it on the fans or the readers to have to answer that. But, I mean, you can always support places like my website or places like Video Game History Foundation. And there's tons of different places out there that you can help with this kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think day to day, I think we're in a much better position now with that kind of thing than we used to be. I think the biggest things we're at risk of losing are more like digital games that, you know, may not get saved. But like, you know, there's like I saw a thing the other day. There's an organization like preserving old Japanese mobile games, which seemed like the kind of thing that would definitely kind of right. fall to the wayside. So like, I think there's lots of things out there that are working in a good direction for that kind of thing. I think the bigger thing is like the bigger message I would send is not to necessarily fans, but just to people who are working on games, because I think it's very easy to assume that something you're working on is not that important and just to kind of like let it go just kind of toss it when you leave a company or something like that. Like even I like there are stories that I'm working on or that I've worked on in recent years where I'm looking back and I'm like, I wish I had saved something from 20 or 30 years ago. Like I used to get all kinds of like preview builds and, you know, interviews and stuff like that, that we didn't use every piece of, that could theoretically be valuable for stories I'm working on now. So like, it's just kind of, I don't know. I'm sort of a minimalist in that way and that I don't kind of keep everything. But sometimes I wish I did. So yeah, I think that's true with people who make games. I think that's true with anybody. So, I don't think everything needs to be kept, but unfortunately you can't know exactly what's going to be valuable in the long run if you don't kind of, plan ahead. So, you know, just kind of works out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Save early, save often, I guess. Like if you leave, take everything that's on the laptop with you, if you can, I think is the mantra here. So we're planning to have you publish a kind of preview of your first design room piece on Rogue alongside the launch of Design Room, right? People will have a chance to sample your content. When can we expect the full version to be available? And how can people best support you? And where will people be able to find you?
Yeah. So the site's going to go up on October 14th, which is Tuesday, because the 13th is a holiday. Hopefully people will like it. It's going to be at designroom.site. It has a Blue Sky account right now that you can. It's probably the best place to follow at the moment, which is designroom.bsky.social. Thank you for. I guess it hasn't happened yet, but thank you for agreeing to host the excerpt of the story. It's going to be, we're going to launch with one big oral history on a game from about 20 years ago that I've been working on for a little while that I think is coming together. I need to actually finish writing that, so I probably should, but it's getting there. And then there's a lot of other stuff. Like it's not just me, it's me and some freelancers are helping out too. So hopefully we'll get a good kind of cadence of these things going. It is a subscription-based site like you would expect from most of these days. The first little while of that is just I'm funding it myself. At a certain point that will stop and it will be kind of up to subscriptions to see if we can keep it going, so we will see. But I'm excited. I hope it'll catch on a little bit.
Cool. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to reading, you know, more of your work. I mean, I've had a chance to, you know, gloss over your oral histories on Final Fantasy and Street Fighter, and those were all very thorough and enlightening and served as like an interesting kind of a foil to the existing kind of like documentaries on those games that already kind of exist. I think that about covers it. Designroom.site is where people can find you and support your work. So look forward to seeing Matt's work up on rogue.site. And if you want to support his work further, visit him on designroom.site and subscribe to him there.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Matt. And we'll hopefully talk again soon.
Okay. Thanks for listening to the interview with Matt Leone. I hope you enjoyed it. And please, please go check out his project and his website. That's going to do it for us for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. While you're here, please consider going to rogue.site and making a paid account for just $7 a month or for $70 a year. You can read every single thing that we write for the website, and you can support cool independent games media while you're at it. If you can't, hey, we get it. We all got laid off this year. If you can't afford to make a paid account, that's totally cool. Go and make a free account for us. That also helps. Sign up for our newsletter. Spread our stuff around. That is also very helpful as we kind of work and grow this thing. It's been a really great first 5-6 weeks here. But it's, you know, all these types of things. It's a long road of growth. We're all very happy with how things are going. And we just want to keep going in that direction. So anything you can do to help us there, sharing us around, make an account, anything helps us. So we are completely reader supported and operated. We do not do ads. We're not reader operated. Sorry about that. We're reader supported. We don't do ads. We don't do sponsorships or anything like that. So
all of us all of can our... read though.
So yes, that is true. True. We all also read our own work. So, and each other's work. So I guess in that way we are reader operated, but no. Yeah. All of our bills paid from this place come from you all signing up and supporting us. So we are very appreciative for all of that. And we will be back next week, like always, to talk more about stuff. I did not talk about my embargoed game this week that I said I was going to talk about last week because I fucked up the embargo like 4 times. Not actually fucked it up. I just said I thought it was Wednesday. It's not. And I thought it wasn't, and I thought it was. And if you listen to last week, there's a whole me fighting with myself for the last 2 minutes or so. It's not. It's tomorrow as this comes out. So we will have cool embargoed stuff on the website tomorrow that you should definitely come check out. And we will talk about it extensively alongside, I think, Steam Next Fest, although we actually probably won't have much experience with it yet at this time for next week's episode. So Steam Next Fest for the next 2 episodes or so. Some cool embargoed stuff coming up. It's becoming that season where all the games are happening. So keep an eye on Rogue. Sign up. If you want to go leave us a 5-star review for this podcast, that would be sick. And we would really appreciate it. But as always, just listening or reading is more than enough. And we really appreciate you. As always, I've been Ryan Gilliam with Jeff Park and Cass Marshall. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.